Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, grief. How do we cope with the loss of a loved one or of a parent or other relative who isn't necessarily such a loved one, with someone with whom you've perhaps had a challenging relationship? What particular challenges do LGBT people face in grieving? How is it different if, for example, you were not out to the person who died or to their friends or relatives? My guests work in the field of grief and bereavement, and they'll have insights for everyone, gay and straight, dealing with grief and loss, and we all have to deal with it at some point. Now, this topic is on my mind because my father died recently in January. He was 92. He'd lived a good long life. His passing wasn't exactly sudden, and nor was it after a long and agonizing illness. We didn't have any big unresolved issues. He had time to say goodbye to me and my brother and my mom and we to him, and we were all able to express our love for each other. So as death goes, I realized we were lucky. In my circle of gay friends, I have many who've gone through really rough times when a parent or family member dies, especially if that relative didn't know or disapproved of their queerness, or if the death was sudden or tragic. And I also know many queer folk who went through the worst of the AIDS years, burying many friends and even lovers. Yet our society rarely discusses death and grieving. This half hour, my expert guests and I will. Susan Castlin is a former psychiatric nurse who now chairs the Grief and Consolation Ministry at Most Holy Redeemer Church, a Catholic church in the Castro. Most Holy Redeemer is offering a free grief support group starting in April. We'll give you information about it a bit later. Susan has researched how grief affects LGBT people and wrote a book about death and dying, Conversations with Richard Purcell, The Adventures and Reflections of a Renegade San Francisco Priest, published in 2012. Richard Purcell was an openly gay Franciscan priest who ran a homeless shelter for gay men and for 20 years in San Francisco's Mission District. He became ill with Lou Gehrig's disease and in his dying process was cared for by some of the very men with AIDS for whom he had taken in earlier. Susan learned a lot in writing that book. Susan Castlin, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Hello, thank you.
My other guest is Reagan Humber. He's bereavement coordinator for Gentiva Hospice, a private hospice services provider. Gentiva's hospice team cared for my father during his final weeks, and the hospice service includes a year of grief counseling to family members. That's how I got to know Reagan. He's also a chaplain with the Episcopal Church. Reagan Humber, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you both for being here on Out in the Bay. So I really want to start with a really basic question, but what is grief?
Well, I would say that grief is something that's very normal. It's not a pathology, and it's something that we all go through if we lose something that's important to us, something or someone. There's usually certain stages that people go through, and if those stages are not interrupted or if there's no problem with them, most people can come out on the other side of grief, and even though they may always miss their loved one, and their life may be forever changed, they're able to get on with their life and enjoy their previous activities and find meaning in their life. However, with a small population, and some researchers think it's between 2 to 25% of the population, something called complicated grief can take place, where grief is not resolved and can turn into ongoing symptoms such as depression, physical illness, or substance abuse, etc. And since we're talking about LGBT people today, I think we may bring up the topic called disenfranchised grief, which often affects people such as ourselves. And there's a strong correlation between disenfranchised grief and complicated grief.
Okay. So before we get too much more into that, Reagan, anything you want to add to that, that general definition of grief?
Well, I think a lot of us, when we hear the word grief, we think of sadness. And sadness definitely is a primary emotion that's involved in grief. However, grief really is the overall experience and process that a person or community goes through when they have a loss. And loss includes death, but doesn't only include death. Grief includes sadness, but it also includes other emotions like anger, frustration, alienation. And it's not only emotional. It's the whole, emotional, spiritual, physical, social experience that a person in a group goes through after and during any loss.
Yeah, and it sort of seems like there's some sort of societal expectations about how you should be grieving or not. My dad was sick over the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and everybody else is happy and doing all their stuff. And I feel, you know, afterwards I kind of felt a little bit of anger. And then when he actually died, I felt some relief. And then I felt shame for feeling relief. And but that seems to be something
exactly.
that's typical, right?
I think that something that we need to mention is that grief is not something that we in this country do a very good job of in general. You know, here today we're talking about LGBT grief, which is a particular form of grief, and we have our own complications and issues. But I think it's not a stretch to say that grief is something that we could all do much better of. And I think one of the biggest problems is that we often do pathologize grief, think it's a problem, and assume it's something that we need to get over rather than just go through.
So, Susan, you mentioned earlier the stages of grief, and is that the kind of thing we hear about the anger, denial? I can't remember the order they come in.
There's a lot of theories that are written about grief, and different theorists come up with different stages. So, but they tend to be similar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so what are the things that tend to thwart people in not going through that or not going through it in a healthy way and then having it come back, you say, long-term later, they may have depression that lasts for a long time?
Well, they may not be able to get adequate support for their grief. And again, getting back to this term of disenfranchised grief, sometimes if there's stigma associated with loss, people may not be able to talk about it. We often associate disenfranchised grief with LGBT people because our very lives are often stigmatized. But disenfranchised grief can happen to anyone. Let's say you had a loved one go to prison. You may mourn that loss, but it's not something you can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't talk about the loss or if you're not getting adequate support for the loss, that can impair your grieving process.
So in this case, you're talking about someone who's gone to prison, so they haven't died, but you're not seeing them in that way. So
no,
it could
no,
be
no.
similar with a relationship breakup.
Right, exactly. That would be a loss as well.
But a loss that we're not allowed to perhaps express as fully as we would for a spouse or partner who's died.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, grief is something that we have to engage. It's something that we have to go through in order to do it well. And I think the main obstacle to kind of avoiding or coping with more complicated grief, the main obstacle is anything that doesn't allow us to actually engage in that grief. You know, I think for gay people, in particular, LGBT people in particular, what Susan was talking about is really important, this idea of disenfranchised grief. You know, grief that doesn't fit into the traditional mold or that others don't see as part of the traditional mold.
Mm-hmm.
Our losses are just the same as everybody else. We lose our parents, we lose our spouses, we lose our pets, we lose our jobs. But when someone says, oh, you can't go through that the way that we go through that, or we're not going to allow you the same space and the same time,
mm-hmm.
Those are the kind of obstacles that really get in the way, particularly in our communities. But that can happen in lots of different communities as well.
So just before we started the taping here, Susan, you mentioned that sometimes there's some study was done of the general population about which situations are most, grief filled or something like that.
Yeah, actually.
Losses that are most significant. And how did that stack up for gay and lesbian people?
Actually, they've done several studies where they ask people just in the general population, how would you rank a loss? And they would list different types of loss. And invariably, people would rank a homosexual relationship as being less valid or less important than a heterosexual relationship or another relationship such as that as a child or a parent. So if people don't think your relationship is significant, they're going to be less inclined to offer support for that
mm-hmm.
loss. Also, sometimes as gay people, we internalize the values of society. So we may not even recognize our own losses as valid. We
mm-hmm.
may not even and see that we may not go through this process because we don't consciously see that our loss was important.
Okay.
I think that's huge. I mean, a huge part of disenfranchisement is that internalization, that we don't ask, you know, for the space that we deserve because we're so used to things being invisible and hiding things that we don't step up and say, hey, I need the same, you know, the same space and the same privileges as other people.
And that happens for other groups in society as well, right?
Oh, all the time.
Any particular examples you can give off the top of your head?
Well, I want to bring up the case of Trayvon Martin, the young black man who was killed last year, and how people, you know, society has this assumption that if a young black man is killed, it's because he was committing a crime. But people were not buying that. They were taking to the street and they were publicly mourning him and they were demanding justice. So that was a case where people were demanding a right to mourn and saying that this loss is significant. You know, the same with Harvey Milk. We saw that after he died and people took to the streets.
Right. I think often we think about grief in terms of personal, private experiences, but there are also, you know, these public systemic forms of grief. You know, the Trayvon Martin case is a good example, but also, you know, I'm thinking in San Francisco now we're going through a lot of housing issues and people are being displaced from certain neighborhoods. You know, a lot of grief can be experienced because of, you know, having to pack up and leave a place, you know.
Yeah, so leave a home that you've had for many, many years. Yeah.
Exactly. I think a lot of times we think of grief as having to do with a person, you know, the death of a person, which is huge and we shouldn't, you know, ignore that. But any kind of loss can produce, you know, I think doesn't can produce any kind of loss is followed by a period of grief.
Okay. Just briefly, how did you, both of you, whoever wants to answer first, get into this field of work? What attracted to you this field of study, this field of work?
Well, I just being a human being and knowing that death is such an important part of our existence, and I certainly have had my own losses. I've worked as a nurse for years, so I've seen people die, worked with people that were grieving. In regards to the gay issue, I had a gay brother who died of AIDS 10 years ago, and that was a very significant loss, a very significant relationship. And I found that getting involved in a support group that specifically dealt with LGBT issues by a gay counselor was very helpful in me processing that loss.
Reagan?
Yeah, I agree. I think that any of us who work in the field of grief or, you know, death and dying, I think we are attracted in the sense of like a magnet to this kind of work. Our life leads us here. And for better or worse, some of us experience, you know, more losses at an early age or at a formative age than others. And I certainly fall into that category. And I think a lot of gay people experience a form of grief, you know, growing up, whether or not they've been able to come out or not, you know, all the things that you might lose during, you know, your childhood and your adolescence, you know, did you get to go to prom with the person that you wanted to go to prom with? You know, did you get to experience the, your life the way that you perceived others were living their lives?
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are Susan Caslin and Reagan Humber. Susan chairs the Grief and Consolation Ministry at Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church in the Castro in San Francisco. Reagan is a bereavement coordinator for Gentiva Hospice and an Episcopal chaplain. After we come back from this very short break, we will talk about the Most Holy Redeemer's Grief Support Group.
Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616.
Welcome back to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. Susan Caslin chairs the Grief and Consolation Ministry at Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood. You've got the support group coming up in April for grief. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's a structured 6-week support group, and it's going to be led by a licensed therapist. It's going to be a free group. Anyone who's interested can contact us at gcm@mhr.org.
GCM stands for Grief and Consolation Ministries. GCM@mhr.org. We'll also have a link on our website, outinthebay.org. And Reagan Humber, Gentiva also offers support groups for grief. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, one of the most wonderful things about hospice in general, you know, hospice is a Medicare benefit. Hospice in general, it is a specialized form of healthcare and caregiving that enhances or seeks to enhance the quality of life of our patients and our families and all those who are connected to our patients and families.
I think we should basically just say really briefly what hospice is, because a lot of people don't even know what that is.
Right, exactly.
So hospice is a way of caring people as they go through the dying process, right? It doesn't
exactly
try to cure them, but tries to honor their dying process.
Right, Right. We focus on quality of life. It's an interdisciplinary form of medicine and caregiving. It's really sort of a miracle of our healthcare system because it hospice, you know, requires and the inclusion of spiritual care, bereavement support, social work, at a much higher level than in other areas of our healthcare system in the United States. And so part of the hospice benefit, and Gentiva provides this like many other hospice providers, is that we follow our families, our loved ones, for, you know, 13 months or sometimes longer after the death. So there's, you know, free grief support, grief counseling, support groups for the friends and family of our patients after they pass away. Gentiva, in particular, in the East Bay, we have two support groups. I run one in Alameda and in San Pablo. They're open to anyone in the community, free of charge. That's part of our services. At this moment in time, we don't have a support group that focuses specifically on LGBT persons and their grief. However, I would like to think that part of my work there is making all of our groups and services open to LGBT people and sensitive to our needs.
Mm-hmm. And is there a website where people can get more information?
Sure. You can go to www.gentiva.com, G-E-N-T-I-V-A.com. It's a national company, so you'll get the national page, but that page will direct you to any local services.
And if someone wanted to find out more generally about hospice, I suppose they could just, you know, Google that or look it up.
Yeah.
Are there websites that are kind of nonprofit, not affiliated with any particular organization that have, like, for example, on the Most Holy Redeemer website, Susan, is there information there in a more general sense?
Regarding death and dying? Or
well, yeah, that's probably not so true, but they could find your support group
at
least.
Yeah, they could. Yeah, they could, yes. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is the National Hospice and Palliative Care organization that people can go to and just, you know, put it into Google, the words National Hospice Palliative, you'll pull up the national organization, and that's a great place for you.
Okay.
General information.
Susan, tell me a little bit more about how did Most Holy Redeemer decide that this support group specifically for grief was something good to have?
Well, it's such a human need, certainly in our population. It's a need. If you know much about the history of Most Holy Redeemer, they were very involved in the AIDS crisis in the 80s. They're right centrally located in the Castro, and they started Coming Home Hospice, which is right across the street from the church. So it's got a long history of dealing with people that are suffering from grief.
So another couple of things that we were talking about before we started the recording here was new losses. Some of the things that people go through with a loss. New losses bringing up previous losses. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I've you know, we study this as to become chaplains, but I've also just experienced it in my own life and in the life of the people that I work with, is that anytime we have a loss, and right now we can talk about death, anytime that someone dies, every other death that we've experienced will come up in some way. Often very, very explicitly, you know, when I'm working with someone will have just passed away, their mother. And, you know, I go to the person and say, how are you doing? Oh, my mother just died, but I'm thinking really hard about my father who died 5 years ago and my aunt who died 2 years before that. Mm-hmm. They all just come to the surface. And so I think for LGBT people, all the other kinds of losses and frustration that we have because of our sexual orientation and because of homophobia, they come up at that moment in time, too. So there is this complexity to it that we should be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone once described grief as a soup. It's like all the old ingredients get thrown into this soup.
Yes.
And the pot gets stirred up all over again.
I recently talked with a woman who lost her sister, and her sister lived back east, and she said we were quite estranged. We weren't close because her sister was quite homophobic. And she said, you know, when she died, I really didn't feel anything because I wasn't close to her. But then all of a sudden I started to mourn for the relationship with the sister that I never had. Hmm. So sometimes losses can be complex.
Exactly, exactly. And I think a lot of times LGBT people, we are grieving, you know, the relationships that we didn't have, you mm-hmm. know, the relationships with our parents that we wished we had had. You know,
that seems to come up among friends. I mean, it seems like friends of mine who were not particularly close to their parents, when one of them dies, they seem to be Much more broken up about it than I thought they would be, or much more angry about it than I thought they would be. But I guess that's part of that relationship you never had.
Right. Or the perception, you know, of a relationship we never had. Because I think one thing we learn as we become adults is that, you know, no one has the perfect parent. Mm-hmm. But I do think that in the LGBT community, because we have this particular experience that marginalizes us, we spend a lot of time thinking about what other people's parents are like, and are our parents, you know, as good as their parents?
Do they measure up?
Do they measure up? And just that kind of existential experience of doing that for so many years, I think, can create the stress that comes up around death of our parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think stress is a good word when you're talking about gays losing someone. Oftentimes there's estrangement in families. So if you're going back to your family of origins, you might be walking into a situation where there was estrangement. There might have been an abuse, and as we know that gay children are at high risk for abuse. So it can be very stressful, very complicated going back to a family funeral.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And when we lose parents in particular, there's a whole generational component where we ask ourselves, oh, are we the next generation? Are we now the elders of our families? And when that happens, especially for LGBT people, I think we must ask ourselves, well, what role am I going to play as an elder? Will I play the same role that, you know, my heterosexual, you know, cousins are playing in their family? Or, you know, I think, you know, that we compare and contrast, and I think a lot of that can be helpful, but it can also create a lot of unnecessary anxiety. But I think that's a really legitimate question.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. One of the things we talked about before was how sometimes family relationships can change. When one person dies, then the relationships between the other people change. Mm-hmm. How have you seen that? Can you give some examples about how that might work or play out?
Well,
or what to watch out for?
Just most generally speaking, you know, one thing that chaplains tend to do well, or at least we were formed to think about families in terms of systems, you know, that the family is sort of its own person. And if you imagine that, you know, you lose your arm or your leg, you're going to have to adjust dramatically to that loss. And so losing a parent, you lose that person and the role that they played in your family.
Or a sibling or anybody.
Or anyone.
Sure.
Yeah,
okay.
You lose anyone. And so it's sort of you go through a period of trying to figure out, well, what's next? How is the family going to function next? You know, if a parent or someone was the caregiver in the family, mm-hmm. The person who took care of everyone in the family, well, how are we going to cope without that? Is someone going to step up to the plate?
Right.
Are we going to look for our caregiving outside of the family? There's a lot of questions that come up.
And you mentioned just a moment ago, you know, going back for a funeral when it's perhaps you weren't accepted in that family in the first place, your family of origin. And then also there's a sort of heterocentrism of funerals and memorial rituals. How does that play in?
Yeah, I've read studies where they've looked at the funeral industry, which can be very heterosexist. For instance, if you read obituaries, usually the survivors are listed in a hierarchical order of their relationship to the deceased, usually starting with the heterosexual spouse, then the mm-hmm. children, siblings, parents. And then if the children or the siblings are married, their heterosexual spouses are listed. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, hopefully this is changing, but that's traditionally what it's been like.
Well, it's funny because actually in writing my own father's obituary, I found myself at the very end doing that thing and going like, you know, my older brother and his wife and their kids and me. I mean, I think I put maybe me and my brother first, but then, you know, but that did cross my mind. I'm not married and don't have a partner that I live with yet, but, you know, maybe one of these days.
Well, God willing.
So, yeah, but I mean, what I'm saying is like, I wouldn't necessarily like, if I think that if I was actually living with him, I probably would have put him down, but I don't know because he wasn't exactly he wasn't a blood relative of my father's.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Well, this is definitely all connected to the definition of family, you know, what is a family? And recently, just some personal experience, I've been doing some genealogical research, you know, kind of trying to put together a family tree. And whenever a same-sex couple comes up in the family tree, there's some difficulty in knowing how to represent them. You know, there's a lot of these software programs and things that everybody knows the names of out there that help us do this. And they are evolving. But more slowly than I think we would like. And it can be really challenging to figure out, you know, what menu do I have to dig deep in order to represent a same-sex partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing in relation to your question, Eric, was when you go into the church, if the funeral's taking place in a church, it's usually the biological family that sits in the front of the church and bids farewell to the coffin. And if there's any legal issues to deal with, such as, you know, maybe decisions to made while the person is dying or ill, it's the biological family that has a legal right, or any inheritance, any property to be sorted out afterwards. So, you know, again, hopefully this is changing now with more people getting married, more gay people.
Mm-hmm. I'm really glad, Susan, that you brought up funeral rites and memorials, because I think that's a really big topic. And I think it's also connected to what you were talking about with the AIDS crisis. I know that as someone who went to theological school many, many years after the AIDS crisis, a lot of the issues that we were struggling with were related to that period. A lot of, you know, gay men in particular experienced, you know, clergy who wouldn't say last rites, wouldn't say a funeral, mm-hmm. in all different kinds of denominations. And we have come a long way since then, but we are still working on what are the appropriate, you know, memorial forms, you know, what are the appropriate rites for same-sex losses that occur in the LGBT community. So, and that's something that all of you can participate in, is, you know, helping the church, helping other faith traditions, helping other, you know, non-faith traditions, secular funeral traditions, think creatively about how are we going to address this.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sort of last, you know, minute or two of care advice, either self-care or how one can help care for grieving friends or loved ones?
Well, I wanted to say something about, you know, well, we've already talked about giving ourselves permission to grieve. I think that's really important. As far as healing, education helps, talking helps. And it's not always friends and family that you can talk to, because they may not know how to listen, or they may have their own grief they're dealing with. So sometimes professional help is necessary. Groups can help, although not everyone is appropriate for in a group. They may not want to be in a group, and they shouldn't be pushed into it if that's the case. But through groups, it breaks our isolation. It helps us learn there's a universality to grief, so we're not alone in what we're going through. And sometimes we can help others. It helps us by helping others.
Thank you, Susan. Yeah, I think that the most important thing, or one of the most important things, is to remember that grief is different for every person. And that, you know, we do talk about stages, and we talk about, you know, there are recognizable things that often happen, you know, from person to person and from family to family. But those are generalities. In reality, each person experiences grief in a different way. And grief is not something that we get over. It's something that we do, and we do over time.
So give yourself permission to feel whatever you feel.
Exactly. And do it. Do the grief. You know, it's something that we have to really do.
You've been listening to Out on the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I want to thank my guests so much for being here. Reagan Humber, who is an Episcopal chaplain and is the...
I'm the bereavement coordinator at Gentiva Hospice.
Thank you very much. Lost
Thank
my notes
you,
there for a second.
Thanks for
and
having
Susan
me.
Caslin, who chairs the Grief and Consolation Ministry at Most Holy Redeemer Catholic Church in San Francisco. If you want to find out about that, there'll be a link on our website, outinthebay.org, to find out about these support groups going on. If you missed part of the broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org. You can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on site, and about a dozen of our favorites from our 9.5 years on the air. That's right, 9.5 years. Out on the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW, our host station, for studio use and airtime, and tonight's engineer, Debbie Kennedy. As an independent production, not a KALW staff production, however, Out on the Bay receives no funds from KALW. We appreciate your financial support. Go to our website. It's tax deductible. Hit the donate button and make a contribution, big or small. And don't forget, matching funds from your employer. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. Learn more about Holly on her blog, hollymead.tumblr.com. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.